views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to episode number 90 of Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. To those of you tuning in for the very first time, I say a thank you. This is a podcast about authentic conversations with real leaders across a variety of spaces. So, what does that actually mean in layman's terms? Well, I sit down with C-level executives and I interview them about their journey. It's my belief that everyone has a story to tell, and my show is here to help them tell their story. Less about the business they're in, and more about the people that they are. I want to know how growing up in a big family influences you, how a job at 13 drives your work ethic, what was your first job? I want to get to know these individuals as best as possible in this hour-long conversation. Yes, it is an hour. And yes, we don't all have that much time. But good news, you can start and stop when you want to continue the conversation. And today is no different. Today on the show, I've got the director of content for C-Suite Radio and the host of Nice Guys on Business, Doug Sandler. Doug and I have a fairly hefty banter back and forth, and it starts off by me actually forgetting his last name. So, with that embarrassing beginning, Doug and I dive into what he's been doing the last 30 years and the business he grew out of Maryland or near DC. And from there, we kind of take a left and a right. We talk about his divorce. We talk about the podcast industry. And we talk about C-Suite Radio and the trajectory of that. And I end the podcast with telling Doug to go fuck himself. So how about that? So stay tuned for that part of the podcast. To those of you who are new to the show, stay tuned. Today on Executives After Hours, Doug Sandler. To those who've listened to many of my interviews, I say thank you. Please leave a review on iTunes. And check out C-Suite Network. They've got C-Suite TV, which is amazing because it's a bunch of TV shows with executives on demand. So you got that going for you. Today also, this is brought to you by Transformation Radio, Transformation Network. I am also now on the Conscious Business Network there. So I'm pretty psyched about that. So, all right. Enough of me yammering and yammering. Have a great week, everyone. Be on the lookout for the bonus episode this week with Joe Friel. If you don't know Joe Friel, Joe Friel is a legend in the triathlon space, one of the first coaches. So it's a fascinating interview. And my wife joins me on that interview, actually, as she is a triathlon coach. All right, lace up those shoes, go for a run, hit the gym, take a walk, or just chill out and have a listen. Have a great week, everybody. To have, holy shit, I just forgot your last name, Sandler.
Jesus, what happened to you? You're already a mess. I mean, I've just got on the air with you and you, what? you want to start over? We can just keep rolling. I'm okay with that. You know my show is very loose.
Yes. No, holy crap. All right. So I guess my point was I appreciate your time and energy to come on Executive After Hours. But after I insult my guests by not knowing their name from the start, Doug Sandler.
And you know me. That's the funny part. You know me. You just froze, man. You froze. I get it. I'm a really easy person to talk to. You can make as many fuck ups as you want to, and I still will stay here and hang out with you.
So point is, I appreciate that, and thanks. And more importantly, I might need a group hug after this, but thank you. Thank you very much for coming on and chit-chatting. And what I'd love to do is have you give me a quick 10,000-foot level before I put you on a couch and try to psychoanalyze you and give you some meds afterwards. So now, Doug, tell me, what do you do as a day job, night job, and weekend job?
I, believe it or not, I am a podcaster. This is part and parcel of what I do. As a result of being a podcaster, I've ended up having a tremendous amount of opportunity that seems to find its way to me over the years. I think somebody that's has 310 episodes or whatever we have of our Nice Guys on Business podcast, opportunity seems to find me. I put my wish list out there to the world, and it seems to make its way back in the form of speaking, training, consulting, teaching organizations how to build rock star brands out of a mediocre brand, and how to really beef up their social media content, how to curate content, how to create amazing content for this digital world that we live in.
You were getting very close to a Donald Trump-esque statement there, by the way.
Oh, no. I didn't give you any alternate facts. Everything I said was correct.
But you said great content and then amazing content, and I was waiting for you to say like bigly content as well on top of that, so...
Yeah, I was going to say tremendous. That was going to be the next word, but it did not come out. I just did not formulate that word.
And so, you know, you have these several hats that you do, right? You have this podcaster, which for you is a full-time gig. You're also in charge of director of content for the C-Suite Radio Network. I know you wear that hat as well because you were kind enough to let me come on and be part of that network. But before you went down this path of podcasting, where are you from originally? Like, are you from North Carolina? Is that right?
No, I'm actually from the Baltimore, Maryland area in USA, US of A, go United States. Believe it or not, I started my entire career right out of college as a part-time DJ. I was DJing at a local bar. I filled in part-time once, and I got hooked with the idea of actually running a party but not actually having to be at the party. I could be there but not have to be on the dance floor. So I've spent the last 30 years of my life as a guy that does the high-end social market in the DC marketplace. So all I do pretty much is I work that Saturday evening event that is a wedding, a bar mitzvah, a corporate gig, whatever it is in this amazing market that we have right here in DC, and loving it. In addition to that, I just kind of reinvented myself a handful of years ago. I wrote a book called Nice Guys Finish First. I started this podcast a couple of years ago. I started speaking. I started training and consulting on the things that I've learned over my building my career for the last 30 years as an entrepreneur and as an entertainer.
So did you grow up loving music, or did you like the power of being in charge of as a DJ?
No, I don't even really love music. I like to sit in silence as I'm driving. Actually, if I can get away from it all over the you know, the hour commute that I might have going back and forth to a job or to, you know, to visit my mom or to go visit my therapist or whatever I'm doing, I'll just sit in silence. It's definitely not the love of music. I think that I got into the world of entertainment and DJing because I love going to parties. But you know that awkward moment when you get into a party and you think, I really thought I wanted to be here, but I really don't know what to do now that I'm here.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me, it became now I don't have to worry about what I do. My hands are staying busy because I'm actually running the event. I have no problem with the pressure of running an event. You know, I've done 3,000 events probably in my career. So at this point, that's not the thing that scares me. What actually scares me is having to have a conversation with one person at that event if I have to.
Are you a natural introvert and you just kind of became an extrovert?
I don't know. I think I don't even know if I would consider myself an introvert. I like people. Yeah, I really do enjoy people. I just don't know how to have I even know how to have a conversation. I don't like that uncomfortable feeling you get when you're feeling like it's about to get awkward. and so I try to avoid that by not doing anything that's going to put me into an awkward situation. And if that means running an event, it actually could mean walking into an auditorium that has 500 or 1,000 people walking up on stage and delivering a keynote speech. I already know what I'm going to say. Well, kind of know what I'm going to say. I know I'm going to be funny. I know I'm going to, not because I'm a funny guy, but because I always find the situation, the funny in every situation that I'm in. So I can pick out somebody that's halfway into the crowd and come up with something about them that I think is funny. And in a non-insulting way, while I'm insulting them, share that with the rest of the audience and make a business lesson out of it. And that, for me, is so fun to be able to put myself in that situation. And where some people might say, God, I'd never want to be in that. That's a horrible scene to be in. That's where I thrive. That's the environment I do best.
You know what's interesting, though, is, and I've heard this repeatedly, is that being in front of 5,000 people is actually easier than one-on-one because it's a sense of anonymity because you don't actually know anyone in the audience. And you're controlling the flow, you're controlling the information. But when it's a one-on-one situation, it's a much more intimate setting. So that kind of leads me to another question then, because there's some unpacking there. So tell me a little bit about, like, growing up just outside Baltimore. I don't know why I thought North Carolina, by the way, just outside Baltimore. Anyhow, did your mom and dad?
I think I know why, because my wife is actually from Charlotte, North Carolina. So that might
maybe
be where
you mentioned
you,
it. Maybe you mentioned it from. That to me.
Or you could be making that up completely. Either way is okay with me.
I'm just going to take the sip of my whiskey and just pretend that it was your wife. But here's my question to you, I want to go back to is, you know, growing up, did you grow up in a family that was well structured? Did you have brothers, sisters? Like, what was your environment as you were like growing up in Baltimore?
It was a great environment to grow up in, even though my parents got divorced. I don't remember it as an unhappy divorce because I was 2 years old and I didn't really have a lot of attachment to my father when he left. That being said, my mom spent the majority of her adult life as I was a child trying the best that she could to make sure that while I wanted a relationship with my dad and she would love me to have had that relationship, I can remember her saying many, many, many times that my father was not worthy of the relationship that I wanted to provide. Because I just kept wanting to, not as a 2-year-old, because who knows, you know,
sure.
What do you know as a 2-year-old?
Yeah, yeah, but as you get the teenage years.
Yeah, as the teenage years and reaching out to my dad and that guy just not being there. And, you know, there's only so much of that mm-hmm. as a mom that she wanted to take because he was not necessary. You know, it was like
they
you had to set an appointment
heart.
To see your. Yeah, yeah. And so she kept seeing this heartbroken, you know, 12-year-old or 13-year-old wanting nothing more than to have a dad figure in his life. And that just was not my father. My stepfather, who my mom remarried, my stepfather, he was a great guy, but he was not the father figure. I think that she kind of kept him at a distance from a authoritative standpoint. I don't know. Again, I don't know the dynamics because sure. I was too young at the time. Mm-hmm. But it would have been nice to maybe have that father figure in my life. I had a brother. I have a brother. He's 4 years older than me. He's in his mid-50s, and we have a good relationship. We have a good time. Mm-hmm. I was married, and then had my starter wife, and then I moved on to my second wife. I had 20 years of marriage, and we just discovered that it just wasn't working out. I really am constantly seeking happiness in my life, and if there's something in my life that is painful or doesn't feel like it's working right, I know that the customary for people to, you know, traditionalists say stay married no matter what, and my feeling was I want to be happy no matter what. So.
Well,
got out
I think
of that
that's
situation.
Fair. And I think that's fair. I was thinking about the comment about your dad, though. You know, my dad, you know, as my audience knows, my dad passed away when I was 20. And, you know, I kind of grew up in a house where both parents worked, both were unhealthy. So that means both were exhausted on the weekends. And so I kind of was in my own little island. And I really feel like that impacted how I related to men older. In terms of authority figures and comfortability and security, did you ever find like you, maybe this was just my issues, but did you ever find that you had difficulties relating to men who were older and like feeling comfortable having a conversation with men older while you were younger? Obviously, as you get older, that obviously changes, but in your 20s, you know, did you ever have that feeling? Does that make sense?
I don't know. I don't. Yeah, it totally makes sense. I don't think conversation or connection was ever a challenge for me. As a matter of fact, I think the people that I end up probably having better relationships with in my life, the men in my life, let's say, that I have better relationships with, are the ones that have a little bit of almost more of like a narcissist complex. I hate to say it that way, but the guys that are very authoritative, not that I want people to tell me what to do, but I find that though the strong men are tend to be men that I have better business relationships in my life.
That's it. Like that's the connection to your dad, right? You wanted that.
Maybe so.
You wanted that framework, and you wanted that discipline, and you wanted that like that male figure showing you how to be professional, business, like whatever term you want to put it as a child. You know, that's what you gravitate towards now because it gives you that feeling of satisfaction, like you're accomplishing something in the eye of somebody else who's superior to you.
And what's really interesting about what you say, James, is that I tend to find that I fill in the gaps for the guys that have that plan that take that authoritative role. Like the guys that are very, very strict and very management heavy, I tend to enter into the relationship with more of the I'm a touchy-feely, huggy-kissy kind of guy. So when I go in and consult with a company, let's say, for example, and they have a very proud leader that is very authoritative, let's say, I will go in there and I will talk to them about the opportunity that they are missing when they're not being showing more gratitude, showing more empathy, developing better relationships with their front line. And that tends to be a very good organization for me to work with because the ones that go that are very authoritative as leaders don't see that they, you know, they're like, they're the kind of guy that says, you know, enough of the pain, show me the baby. You know, mm-hmm. It's like, all right. So those are the organizations that I tend to do very, very well with in terms of what I do professionally. Personally, mm-hmm. I like that part of, you know, because I like some people to make some decisions for me. I'm not a great decision maker. I make a decision
you're a pleaser,
like on the fly.
Probably.
Yeah, totally, totally a pleaser. Now, I will make good out of any situation that happens. So I might say yes. And I'm like, how the hell am I going to figure this out? And then figure it out. Mm-hmm. So I'm not a fleeting thought kind of guy. It's, I put some thought into it. We say yes, and I want to please whoever I'm dealing with. But then we're going to figure out how to make it work. I love saying yes. If I can say yes, I want to.
So then how does someone who – because I'm trying to figure out this connection to DJing for, you know, would you say 30 years, 20 years?
20 yeah, years? Yeah. I started in 1984 as a junior in college.
So, okay. So there's got to be something about it that really – made you stick with it, right? So I'm a huge believer in the first layer of justification is only the first layer, and the real reason is usually two layers down. And so, you know, earlier when you mentioned the fact that you like DJing because you could be at a party but not be at a party.
Well, I could probably tell you. I mean, I don't mean to go around my asshole to get to my elbow, but I can probably tell you why.
I want to see that, by the way. Just
yeah, very interesting. I think what I always go back to, and I think about this a lot, James, because it is one of those things that has been the constant in my life. You know, the joke in my family was, and I always had a part-time job as I was having my part-time job as a DJ too, and I always joke about it that my job as a salesperson, I didn't have 20 years of sales experience. I have 1 year of sales experience 20 times because I probably had 20 jobs. Okay. So part of what I deal with as an entertainer is I seek approval. I constantly am seeking approval. I don't know if that's part of a self-analysis that I've done or just trying to figure out, why is it that – say it again.
Totally is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean – I love, like you said before, I am a people pleaser. What ended up happening as a result of being a people pleaser, I found this career of being me as a DJ. I'm able to bring my personality to every event with me. And then I started getting paid really well to do it. So I wasn't that $300 and $400, you know, when you have a barbecue DJ, they come and they, you know, you're paying them a few hundred bucks to do the event. When they started paying $5,000 and $6,000 and $10,000 to have me come to do an event for them, then the money started to take over and my entrepreneurial side just said, hey, I can make a huge business out of this. So when you're working one day a week and you're making what your friends are making in, you know, 5 or 6 days a week, and you're making it for 4 hours on a Saturday night, they and you're partying, they're like, what the hell is this Sandler guy? What has he been doing? And so it did evolve into now it's not just about pleasing people. This is about pleasing the others in my life, my first wife, my kids, my banker, my everybody, the guy that I sold me the cars that I've bought and the Harley that I have, and you know, the stuff that I have in my life that doesn't mean shit anymore. But you know, you realize that when you get to some ripe old age of maybe 40.
Yeah.
So once you start to realize that stuff doesn't matter, then you start to take a whole different perspective. So pleasing people stopped being about just pleasing my clients. It was about pleasing the other people around me. And, you know, the lifestyle stuff got to be really important. And then you get those golden handcuffs, which is always challenging too, because now you get to a point where you're stuck. You know, you've built up this lifestyle and you can't.
Yeah.
I'd loved at some point to be able to have said, you know, maybe 10 years ago, I have to slow down. This is not good for me, because I'm built a business and I got, you know, 12 other guys that are doing this for me, and we're working 900 jobs a year and I'm busy 24/7 just trying to catch up with everything. It was hell on wheels. And so I needed a change in my life.
And so, you know, over this time that you're DJing, and I think the DJing initially probably started just, you saw the power to please a large audience of people. Like, I would imagine on a psychological level there, for me, there would probably be a lot of power in that. And I don't mean power in a controlling way. I mean power in a sense of, I can make all these people happy by spinning this record, right?
I think there was a certain amount of power in making people happy. And I think that is exactly, you get a thrill out of pleasing people. When you not only get paid to do what you do, but you get the emails and the letters and the calls on Monday morning saying, wow, that's amazing. I could never control a crowd of 150 people the way that you did. How did you do that? When is the next time you can work for us again? And we're going to pay you more next time because we know you're worth more.
So that's an awesome feeling. There's satisfaction to that, right? So your job satisfaction, at least for most of that time, was probably pretty high. I'm sure you had some pretty shit gigs at some point, but but, like, you know, kind of taking a right turn right now, kind of going back to your marriage. Not that I wanted your ex-marriage. I delved too much into that.
But that's all right.
I don't want to go. I don't want to dive too deep into what happened in your marriage. I think that your previous marriage. What I want to know is, how many children do you have from that marriage?
I have two kids, and feel free to, there is absolutely nothing that's off the rate. I think I told you this before. You ask me whatever questions you want to. I'm happy to answer them for you.
So how, your kids are older now?
My kids are 20 and 23. My son is 20 and my daughter is 23.
And are they at university, or are they?
Yep. My son is a junior at a local state college here in Maryland, and he's studying graphic design. And my daughter, Rachel, is a first year master student and studying music at Peabody.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, she's the talented one in the family.
Now, with the divorce after 20 years, were you and your wife able to separate amicably, or was there some angst in the process?
I think that with any separation, there's always going to be that little bit of or that lot of argument that goes on.
Sure.
But what I have found that happened, which was great, was that we actually have since gotten to be, I would say, good friends. I mean, I think that as good of friends as you can possibly be, you know, my wife is still connected to me through my kids and through my history with her. So we have events that we go to together. My family loves my ex, and that's quite acceptable. And I would never tell them that they couldn't, you know, be friends with her. Nor would I want to. So most of my family events, it's me and my wife, my current wife, my ex-wife, my two kids, and everybody. And it's, you know, we make it as great as we can possibly make a situation that unfortunately happened in that's, you know, in the divorce.
Sure. How old were your kids when you got divorced?
So I think my son was 14 or 15, and my daughter was, I guess that would make her 18 or 19.
How did they take that process?
I think that like all kids, your kids don't want to see their parents split up. I have proven, and she and my ex has proven to them through the years, that you can have a relationship that doesn't work and still have a friendship or a relationship on the other side of that. Too many times we hear about, whether through the media, you know, depicting what goes on with divorce, or just through the news and all the bad crap that goes on out there. We are the couple that would probably be the model couple for divorce if you're going to get divorced and still remain in good relationship. And that was by design. You know, I don't dislike my ex-wife. I just didn't want her as a wife.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like there was any infidelity that was going on that broke up our marriage, and there was no ulterior motives other than I spent a lot of time in that marriage. I wasn't happy. I didn't see it being able to get fixed, and it was on me. I mean, my ex-wife probably would have stayed married for the rest of our lives because that's what her family did. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying my family got divorced, so we got divorced, but I did not see that in any kind of future that I was going to be happy, and I didn't know how to correct that other than just make a major reposition and reinvention of my life, and which is exactly what I did.
It almost seemed to me too that answer me this, I guess, that there was a part of you that probably stayed in the marriage longer because you came from a divorced family. Do you think?
So I probably stayed longer than my happiness stayed because I wanted to try to make it work out. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, I think that my ex-wife would give you an argument about that. I think that she would probably say that I did not try hard enough to make it work out. But I think – I really do think – you know, you go through the counseling thing and you go through that. Sure. And I think that the issue with that is that your counseling really does – bring up a lot of things. Yeah. It really does expose a lot.
Yeah.
And that more or less made it a raw nerve for me. Mm-hmm. So I think that the counseling actually hurt rather than helped. But you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. If I did not go to the counseling, then I really wouldn't have been trying. So I at least, even for a limited short period of time, tried to do that. But
it seems like you really believe in the concept, the concept of life just kind of happens and you gotta be flexible with it. And for you, it seems like the center of everything is focused on maintaining a healthy perspective in life, right? Being happy.
I just think that if I didn't make a move, if I didn't make a major change, and I know looking back, man, I'm sure I created, and you don't realize until you go through it how many dominoes are affected as a result of you getting divorced. You know, you're not just marrying the woman or the man; you are marrying their family as well.
I think my wife's family would be happy.
Well, you know, what's interesting that you say that, you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. I think that part of the issue that I. There was a lot of dominoes that fell as a result and were affected, maybe not fell, but a lot of dominoes were, or a lot of things were upset and overturned. And, you know, there's family, you know, I was not that I didn't care about them. I do. I love them and I still love them very much. I just couldn't stay in a situation that was, that I needed to be happy myself. And I give advice like this all the time. And I say, you either have to figure out how to make yourself happy or you got to move on. And should I have tried to make myself happy? Should I have stayed in there a little bit longer? I don't know. I don't know, James.
Yeah.
I mean, we could second guess this for the rest of our lives. And you know, my feeling is let's just keep moving.
Yeah.
You
know? I actually think that, you know, and I've had this conversation with my wife, you know, and I said that about my wife's family tongue in cheek, by the way. I think her brothers would love me forever. I'm not sure about her parents, but I'm pretty sure about her brothers. But I think that, you know, if you don't take care of yourself in a marriage, the fraying on the fringes, you know, I'm going into my 10th year, and I think that the fraying on the fringes of life will wear at you if you don't have a strong core fiber to yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's something that I spend a lot of time focusing on. I'm not always happy. I'm sometimes cranky, but I'm totally human and that's fine. And I try to make sure that, you know, last Saturday, for example, I was feeling really stressed out. Like I have a lot of stuff going on. And I just said, can I please just go golfing? Like, I need a few hours by myself, hitting a stupid white ball, screaming at it, and feeling better when I'm done in 3 hours.
Yeah, and, that's a good thing.
And she, you know, luckily enough, is super supportive. And that's, I think that's because I also give a lot in the house, right? Like, I don't just take for myself. I help with the kids. I get them, you know, lunches and breakfast and take them to school. And I'm at all their events and I still do my stuff. And so, you know, I think that, you know, when you're in a marriage, and I'm sure you totally agree with this, that if you're not able to take care of yourself and maintain your level of happiness, I'm not talking euphoria, but I'm talking a level that is manageable for most of the time, that it just eats at you. You start creating and getting bitter. And,
yeah,
you know, once bitter happens, it's a tough pill to swallow and deal with. One more quick question before the Fast Five. I was just thinking about this because it's a pretty pertinent question. What made you decide to go all in on podcasting? And just so my audience knows, you know, your podcast is quite successful. It's got a great, great audience. You do 5 episodes a week. I think it's 3 with guests and 2 with you and your co-host.
Right.
And, you know, it's nice guys on business. And it's a great, you know, 25 to 30 minutes of your life. It's entertaining. You know, what made you decide and just pivot and say, I'm going all in on the podcast?
I think what happened was podcasting really found me. Now, when I say that, I made a conscious effort to become a podcaster. I had never even really listened to a podcast before I was already hosting mine. And that was 2 years ago. And so when my co-host and I discussed, or my friend, probably one of my best friends at the time, it said to me, or I said to him, hey, why don't we start a podcast? I think he probably said, what's a podcast, or something like that. We just said, hey, we're just going to try it. And then I used the podcast as a way to get my message out. It was just a different channel, you know, just like Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter are all channels to get your, you know, in social media, podcasting and blogging are just different, and YouTube are just different ways to get your message out and your content out. So, I started to do that we started with, I think, 2 episodes a week. And then I started to get more demand than I had supply of days. I had more demand to be on my show from guests. And we just started to really pick up the pace, and we went to 3. And then we discovered that our best episodes were the ones that just my co-host and I just spending like part of the episode just shooting the shit and just talking about everything and nothing, business and life in general. And so we said, why don't we just do a couple of episodes like that? We were just doing it temporary. Like 30 days, I think, was the plan to do 5 episodes a week just to build our audience. And that was about almost a year ago. And we can see a direct spike in our listenership when we went to the 5 episodes a week and started adding more personality and more of a conversation and more explicit content to the show, just like we're just doing on your show right now. Mm-hmm. And our listening audience went from something like 800 or 900 listeners a month, or 900 downloads a month. It spiked to like 4,000 and 5,000. And then the next month it was like 6,000. And, you know, we have on pretty regular basis have anywhere between 40 and 45,000 downloads a month right now.
Wow.
And while that's great, it's nowhere near where we can see that this thing is going. I mean, our goal eventually is to have 100,000 downloads a month. I'm looking forward to 2017 being the year that we hit 1 million downloads, you know, overall. And right now we're at 350,000.
We've got sidetracked and I need to get to Fast Five. So
do it, man. Do it.
Are you ready for Fast Five?
I am. I'm ready to do it.
Question numero uno, Mr. Doug Sandler. What was your first? I'm trying to build the suspense.
I'm ready. I'm ready.
You're on the edge of your seat. What was your first job ever?
Oh, geez, really? Like age 13, that kind of job?
Yep.
Okay, so I worked at a place called Jeffrey's Ski Hut when I was 13 years old. That was the first job that I ever had. It made me develop a connection with a W-2 and with money, and I discovered one of two things. One, I loved money, and second, I never wanted to work for anybody ever again in my entire life. I was unpacking skis in the off season so that they could get readied for people that were going to go skiing in the wintertime.
Awesome. Question 2. What animal best represents your management style?
What a beaver.
That could go. I don't know how real that is, or if you want the shock factor. I'm not sure which one that goes with.
Well, wait, did you say what animal best describes your management style?
Yeah.
Okay, so that would be a beaver, because or an otter, a beaver or an otter, because they're fun to look at and they're cute and stuff, and they really feel like you really feel like you could have them as a pet and enjoy them. But when it comes down to it, they got a job to do, and that job for a beaver is to build a dam or to build their whatever their well a den. Yeah. And my feeling is that I'm a real fun guy to be around, and I love hanging out, and I love partying, and I love enjoying my life. But I'll tell you something, I fucking get stuff done. You know, you want shit done. You ask me, it will get done. I want it off of my list. I love crossing things off my list.
You know, one of the interesting things about these questions is I ask the same ones again and again. But to backtrack to the job one, the amount of highly successful people who started their first job between 10 and 13 is unbelievable to me.
Really?
I mean, unbelievable. And, you know, I probably have a whole book just in this, but easily 70-75% of the people, and this is over 85, I guess you're 92 now, but like 90 interviews, about 70-75% were newspaper deliverers. The first
job. Okay.
Fascinating.
Yeah, I had a neighbor that owned a store, and it was the easiest thing for me. I would ride in the morning with him, and he would just bring me home later on that night. So it made it pretty easy.
It just teaches you to work at a young age and be responsible.
I loved working. Working for me again was my connection with. I got to buy stuff. So at the time, it was skateboards and probably
me too.
Yeah, because all that wacky pack stickers and I don't even remember what else. Just whatever. I was a fad guy, so whatever fad that came through my neighborhood is the thing I wanted to be a part of.
What was your first skateboard?
Oh geez, I think that there was a something in Smith, Gordon and Smith. I think was the name of a skateboard.
I'm trying to think. Mine, I can't say the name. It was Cabriello.
I don't know. I don't know. When I first started skateboarding, it literally was two skates or four skates that were nailed onto the bottom of a 2x4 kind of board. Mm. And then skateboarding really started to get hot in the mid-70s, which is when I was a kid. And then my neighbor and I, he was a skateboarder too. We built a ramp in our backyard.
Yes.
And we would drive our neighbors crazy with the thud thud of the wheels going up the ramp in the middle of the, you know, we would even skateboard in the dark. We didn't give a shit.
I did all of that too. So, all right. Question three, what advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Ooh, that's a good one. I would tell my 25-year-old self that it is okay to fail and not to worry about it so much.
Why do you think it's such an interesting thing, right? Because entrepreneurs in of themselves should be okay to fail. What do you think?
It hurts though, James. It hurts. Failure sucks, man.
Yeah. I guess I just fail so often that I become numb to it, I think.
I do too, but I think we put a different definition on failure.
True.
There's a difference between failing and quitting. You know, failing and continuing is you're on your way to success. Failure and quitting is really bad. So as long as you don't quit, you know, you're okay. And that, you know, I won't bring up the whole marriage thing again, but you know, that's part of the disappointment in the, cause I quit, I really quit. And that disappoints me and that hangs over my head to a certain degree. But you know, again, I had to move on. I think there's greater things that were down the road than the feeling that I was going to get the downside, which was the quitting aspect of it.
And I actually think, you know, sometimes it's, you also have to know when to quit. You know?
Yeah, I agree.
And I think that sometimes is the tougher realization is I need to actually stop, you know? So, all right. Question four. What do you want people to say about you at your funeral?
Well, this is really an easy one because this is one that I actually share with any of my family. I always tell them, you know what I want you to say at my funeral, right? And I know, that might sound morbid, but the idea behind it is I want people to understand where I'm coming from throughout my entire life. I really want people to say these words, "He made me laugh." If I can get that, if I can get people to say that about me, I feel like I have been a success in life because my goal is to make people happy. He made me laugh. That's all I want. I want it on my headstone. I want it wherever you can put it. He made me laugh.
All right. Last question. This is a newer one for me. I'm toying around with this last question. So it's a would you rather question. And no, okay. It's not a drinking game type of question. Would you rather be stuck in the ocean all your life or stuck on an airplane for the rest of your life?
Stuck in the ocean or stuck in an airplane? Well, do I get to ask questions about either one of those, or is it just you have to build the scenario around this?
See, you're not supposed to push back on the question. Sure. Okay. You can ask me questions about it. Why not?
Okay. So let me set up the scenario then. Would I rather be on an airplane? If there were people on the airplane, I probably would rather be on the airplane.
By yourself in both cases.
Well, okay. If I'd rather be in an airplane, I think I'm going to get somewhere if I'm on an airplane. It does not sound like this is a permanent situation. If I'm in the ocean, I just keep thinking just the whole idea of being on a raft in the ocean just is not good. If I was on a deserted island, it's almost like that'd be okay. At least I have a place to hang my hat.
But you know what that says though about you is that one makes you feel like you're going someplace, like you're doing something, you're being something. One is kind of like, you know, being stuck in the ocean is kind of being stuck with being okay with being nowhere.
Yeah. Well, again, part of what you're saying is the same question asked in a different way. Would you rather be stuck in traffic knowing that you're going to be there in an hour, or would you rather be moving knowing that you're going to be there in an hour? And my answer would be, it's easy there. I'd much rather be moving than sitting in traffic. Why? Because I'm going somewhere. I don't want to be stuck anywhere.
I don't know. I could get a 10-minute nap in there. I think I'd be pretty happy with that. I'm just kidding. All right.
I could get the nap too, but I want to keep moving. Yeah, I want to keep moving. Life is about moving, and I want to keep moving.
I agree. All right. Thank you for doing Fast Five, which is never fast, but it's still five questions. So
that's okay. It's good. It was good.
All right. Last 5-10 minutes with you. What I want to talk about really is this new endeavor that you're on now, you know, and you started doing this. I don't know when you started working with C-Suite, which by the way, is so hard to say that fast. So talk to me about the concept of C-Suite, what's its intent, just the whole idea where it came from.
Well, C-Suite is just a collection of it's a community. It's a community of C-level execs that have common thoughts, that have common influences, that have a common denominator, that they're all these executives on the C-level. And so Jeffrey Hazlett put together this group that if he puts them together and they have collective thinking, probably there's an opportunity for have collective buying as well. So the C-Suite network is many, many different consultants, advisors, people that are put together that can provide services, content, information to the C-level execs. So everybody wins. The C-level execs win because they get information that's vetted. The C-suite advisors win because they are the providers of the service. So it's a winning situation that needed a middleman to kind of put it all together. Mm-hmm. And what Jeffrey Hazlett and the C-suite network have done is create an environment where there's TV, there's radio, there's books, and there's content that's being provided on both sides. So he's really just the middleman that's created this entire network, which is very cool.
And so what's been the early feedback from people on the concept of having a podcast network? This is a very self-serving question, by the way.
No, that's okay. I think it's interesting. As director of partnerships for the C-Suite Radio Network, I didn't have to take the job. I could have always said no to the job. What I thought was really cool about it was that it was putting content podcasting content in the hands of the C-level execs. And what we're doing is we're taking shows that may not have exposure to this large network, and we're saying, okay, do you want in on this network? Not only are we going to give you access to the network, but we're going to help promote you too. And not only are we going to help promote you, but we're also going to provide you with an opportunity to have advisors on your show that can advise the network. So you're going to be a smaller Jeffrey Hazlett. You're going to be an influencer with that audience that you have that's made up of C-level execs too. So the whole idea, it is kind of cool. I really did think the idea, and I do think the idea is good. Now, the proof is in the pudding. So, and we're saying that literally, what's today? Today's like, as of the recording of this, it's now the 14th of February. Correct. So we're now 14 days into the launch of this network. Years to build it, we're now 14 days into it. The proof is in the pudding. Whether we can deliver on what we are promising is a different story. I'm hoping through action that we are going to prove what we have been telling these podcasts, yours being one of them, that we're going to do. We're going to help you build your reach. We're going to help provide you with better content and guests. We're going to help you. We're going to help deliver sponsorship to you. And we're going to help you really create a brand through the C-Suite network that's going to help you monetize what you do. And if we can deliver on all those things, man, that would be doesn't that sound like that would be really cool?
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that that really drew me to, you know, you and I had a lot of conversations about this. And, you know, I was trying to decide if this is something I wanted to launch into. But one of the things that really, and I'm trying to find it right now, but I can't seem to find it, is just the board that he's put together for this network. Like he's brought in some pretty significant players from a C-level perspective to be part of, you know, the board of directors. And I think that adds a lot of credence to what he's trying to do. Because he's trying to do it professionally, not ad hoc, not a hobby, but as something that has merit and hopefully some teeth in the marketplace, you know, to capture a specific audience. So you know, I got excited. When Jeffrey approached you to do this, you know, was there any major discussion about what ifs? Or was it kind of like an all in, like you're either in or you're out?
No, I think Jeffrey is a very no bullshit kind of guy. So I think what was great about the conversation that I had with him is he basically said, do you think this is something that you can do? And me being a people pleaser, I said, absolutely, I can do it. Not really knowing if I could do it or not. I mean, I've never sold for Jeffrey. I don't know his management style. I don't know anything about him. You know, his whole approach, his whole attitude was think bigger or go home, you know. Mm-hmm. So he kind of, again, I tend to align very well with guys that are very authoritative, and that's his scene. I mean, he is somebody that I think can take me professionally places that I've never been before. So I'm okay with giving this a shot. I mean, a year ago, I didn't know who Jeffrey Haislett was, mm-hmm. you know, and it, like you said, it's amazing the people that you're going to meet as a result of having a podcast that completely can change your life on a dime. He could be that guy in my life. There was many people that I've met through this podcast that could be that guy in my life. He presented me with an opportunity that I thought was one that was a good risk mm-hmm. and a good opportunity. And then I do things like what you did. You investigated him a little bit and you see, hey, look who's on his board. You know, hey, look who are these people that he's associating with? Look at his following on social. Look how big that he is. And for me, all of those added up to it makes sense. It's worth the risk. I'm only hearing good things about this guy. The worst thing that can happen is it doesn't work, mm-hmm. right? Nobody dies. You know, Jeffrey's attitude is nobody dies. It's fine. And I agree.
Yeah.
We're all trying this together. You're taking a risk. I'm taking a risk. My reputation's on the line too, which is why I like to keep the relationship open with everybody. I try to do as much of this, and I'm not doing this for PR purposes, James. I'm doing this because I think you're a good guy. But for me, I
who's
also
paying
wanna,
you?
I'm
Tell
also,
me who's paying you. I want to know.
Sorry. I'm also trying to also balance my reputation in this too, because if something happens to this, I want people to know that it's not working because I'm not giving it my effort.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's fantastic, and you know, it helps to have you doing your role, because I think it suits your personality.
Yes, totally.
You know, and so I think that's helpful for you sifting out. How do you guys sift through what content you think CEOs would want to hear, or C-suite level executives?
I think we listen to the people that are in our advisory group. There's about 150 people that are C-suite advisors. These are people that provide us with their content, and we look to them to help us determine what is the best content for the market. The other side of it is go the other way. We also hear from the C-level execs at conferences many times throughout the course of the year, and they're telling us what content they want. So if we can marry the content providers and the content seekers together, we have a winning proposition. And that's the way we looked at this network. That's the way we looked at the bestsellers for the books. That's the way we looked at our TV. That's the way we looked at our entire network, and just kept saying, if the advisors are recommending this and the audience, the market wants this, the network wants this, let's provide it and let's be that go-between person and capitalize as a result of it. It's, you know, this is a, it's a great way to make a living. Everybody seems to get happy here.
And is there a concern that you guys will give almost two content and you'll become paralyzing for your audience to kind of select what they want to watch or hear or book to read, for example?
I don't know. I go to Amazon right now and you can just type in a category and you can get a book on any category that you want. Why can't we do that with the C-suite network? Why can't a C-level exec go to a search engine and of ours and type in the words whatever, marketing content or social media, and get 20 choices of social media and let them, the cream is always going to rise to the top. You know, it's the same thing that you said earlier, isn't the market going to be saturated with podcasts? I don't give a shit. As long as my podcast is on top, I don't care if it gets saturated. And the way to do that is to have relevant content. Don't get lazy. You know, always keep your ear out to what's new and what's hot, and do your best to, and don't be afraid to fail. Take risk. Yeah. If you can keep all those things in mind as you build your business, it's the same with anything that goes on. Yes, everything can be saturated, but you know, there's always going to be somebody that's going to be cheaper, better, different. As long as you just keep moving, dodging, and keep going, I think you're going to be okay.
Excuse me, I got two questions for you, and I will let you run and do your day job. Question.
I think I just did it.
I know, I was tongue in cheek there. Question one is, you know, I was thinking about this because I think you exude some of these qualities, and I think you surround yourself with individuals that exude the same qualities. But if you were to pick one defining factor that's the most important, what would it be for an authentic leader?
I think the answer is in the question, and you just gave me the answer. What is one defining factor of being an authentic leader? The word is authentic. If you're a leader and
but
you
how
provide,
would you define that, right? Like, what would be an attribute that you would
ascribe? Oh, I got you. Yeah. Okay. Well, to be open to the people that work on your team, to be a leader that doesn't just lead from the ivory tower, but leads from the front line, to be a guy that's always telling the truth, regardless of that, it potentially could be hurting to your organization. I think that this is an overused word, but it's a word that kind of makes sense in this authenticity is transparency. Mm-hmm. If you can be a leader that leads and people understand why you're leading the way that you do and why you're being authentic and why you're showing gratitude and why you're being empathetic, it's not just out of ulterior motives, but because of the love of your organization, you can only win. I've spent my entire career telling the truth, being honest, and returning my phone calls. You know, I've spent my entire career being that guy, just the guy that returns phone calls. I'm on time to my meetings. I reach out.
You respect people's time and energy. Like, that's fair. I totally
you
agree
take
with
that
you.
You take that into any work, anything that you do, and you're going to be successful. It could take you longer if you don't try to shortcut. You can't shortcut this thing. Mm-hmm. It's just how it's done. It's how it's done.
All right. Last question. Tell me, how do you, for who you are, how do you define happiness?
That's a good one. I think that happiness is being successful. It is defining success in the way that you want it to be defined. So success does not necessarily mean money. I think that, you get to a certain point in your life where you just say, man, there's got to be other ways to define what successful is other than just dollars, because I know plenty of people that have a lot of money but that are miserable leeches. You know, so for me, I would say that happiness is being successful at what I am trying to accomplish in life. It's, if I'm going to be a podcaster, I don't need to be the richest podcaster in the world. I just have to enjoy what I'm doing. So happiness is doing what I want to do, when I want to do it, with whom I choose to do it with. I guess that's really what it comes down to.
Awesome. Well, Doug Sandler, thank you so much for your time, your energy, your enthusiasm, and your willingness to sit down and chat with me on Executives After Hours. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I appreciate all your energy.
Now, if you can just figure out how to get this down to 10 minutes worth of editing, after editing, you'll be in good shape, right?
Fuck off.
final words. That's exactly what it's going to be. It's the grand F off. That's good. Now, I enjoyed it, James. You have a good show. You're going to be a good guy. I mean, you're going to, yeah. It's just going to keep, this is going to continue to snowball until you go straight to hell.
I appreciate the enthusiasm and positive reinforcement.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.